The night was pitchy dark. In the first gust of wind, their temporary torches were extinguished, and only the red brands dancing and flitting in the gloom like drunken will-o'-the-wisp indicated their whereabouts. Their way led up Pine Tree Canyon, at the head of which a broad, low, bark-thatched cabin burrowed in the mountainside. It was the home of the old man, and the entrance to the tunnel in which he worked, when he worked at all. Here the crowd paused for a moment, out of delicate deference to their host, who came up panting in the rear.
"Perhaps you'd better all hold on a second out here, while I go in and see that things is all right," said the old man, with an indifference he was far from feeling.
The suggestion was graciously accepted. The door opened and closed on the host, and the crowd, leaning their backs against the wall and cowering under the eaves, waited and listened. For a few moments there was no sound but the dripping of water from the eaves, and the stir and rustle of rustling boughs above them. Then the men became uneasy, and whispered suggestion and suspicion passed from one to the other.
"Reckon she caved in his head the first lick? Decoyed him into the tunnel and barred him up, likely. Got him down and sitting on him. Probably biling something to heave on us. Stand clear of the door, boys."
For just then the latch clicked. The door slowly opened, and a voice said,
"Come on in out of the wet."
It was the voice of a small boy, its weak treble broken by the preternatural hoarseness which only vagabondage and the habit of premature self-assertion can give. It was the face of a small boy that looked up at theirs, a face that might have been pretty and even refined, but that it was darkened by evil knowledge from within, and dirt and hard experience from without. He had a blanket around his shoulders and had evidently just risen from his bed.
"Come in," he repeated. "Don't make no noise.
The old man's in there talking to Ma," he continued,
pointing to an adjacent room which seemed to be a kitchen. The men, entering quietly, ranged themselves around a long table of rough boards which occupied the center of the room. Johnny then gravely proceeded to a cupboard and brought out several articles which he deposited on the table.
"Thar's whiskey and crackers and red herrings and cheese."
He took a bite of the latter on his way to the table.
"And sugar."
He scooped up the mouthful and wrought with a small and very dirty hand.
"And terbacker. There's dried apples, too, on the shelf, but I don't admire 'em. Apples is swelling. Thar," he concluded. "Now wait in and don't be afraid. I don't mind that old woman. She don't belong to me. So long."
He had stepped to the threshold of a small room, scarcely larger than a closet, partitioned off from the main apartment and holding in its dim recess a small bed. He stood there a moment looking at the company, his bare feet peeping from the blanket, and nodded.
"Hello, Johnny. You ain't going to turn in again, are ye?" said Dick.
"Yes, I are."
"Well, what's up, old fella?"
"I'm sick."
"How sick?" "I got a fever and chilblains and rheumatiz," returned Johnny, and vanished within.
After a moment's pause, he added in the dark, apparently from under the bedclothes,
"And biles!"
There was an embarrassing silence. The men looked at each other and at the fire. Even with the appetizing banquet before them, it seemed as if they might again fall into the despondency of Thompson's grocery, when the voice of the old man, incautiously lifted, came deprecatingly from the kitchen.
"Certainly, that's so. In course they is, a gang of lazy drunken loafers, and that are Dick Bullen's the arniest of them all. Didn't have no more sabi than to come round yar with sickness in the house and no provision. That's what I said. Bullen, says I, it's crazy drunk you are, or a fool, says I, to think of such a thing. Staples, I says, be you a man, Staples, and expect to raise hell under my roof and invalids lying around. But they would come, they would. That's what you must expect to trash as lays around the bar."
A burst of laughter from the men followed this unfortunate exposure. Whether it was overheard in the kitchen, or whether the old man's irate companion had just then exhausted all other modes of expressing her contemptuous indignation, I cannot say. But a back door was suddenly slammed with great violence. A moment later, and the old man reappeared, happily unconscious of the cause of the late hilarious outburst, and smiled blandly.
"The old woman thought she'd just run over to Miss McFadden's for a sociable call," he explained as he took a seat at the board.
The party's natural audacity returned with their host. I do not propose to record the convivialities of that evening. The inquisitive reader will accept the statement that no glasses were broken in the absence of any, no liquor was spilt on the floor or table in the scarcity of that article. It was nearly midnight when the festivities were interrupted.
"Hush," said Dick Bullen, holding up his hand.
It was the querulous voice of Johnny from his adjacent closet.
"Oh, Dad!"
The old man arose hurriedly and disappeared in the closet. Presently he reappeared.
"His rheumatiz is coming on again bad, and he wants rubbing."
He lifted the demijohn of whiskey from the table and shook it. It was empty. Dick Bullen put down his tin cup with an embarrassed laugh. So did the others. The old man examined their contents and said hopefully,
"I reckon that's enough. He don't need much. You hold on, all of you, for a spell, and I'll be back."
He vanished in the closet with an old flannel shirt and the whiskey. The door closed, but imperfectly, and the following dialogue was distinctly audible.
"Now, sonny, where does she ache worst?
Sometimes over yar, and sometimes under year, but it's most powerful from year to year. Rub your dad."
A silence seemed to indicate a brisk rubbing. Then Johnny,
"Having a good time out here, Dad?"
"Yeah, sonny."
"Tomorrow's Christmas, ain't it?"
"Yes, sonny." "How does she feel now?"
"Better. Rub a little further down."
"What's Christmas anyway? What's it all about?"
"Oh, it's a day."
This exhaustive definition was apparently satisfactory, for there was a silent interval of rubbing. Presently, Johnny again.
"Mar says that everywhere else but here, everybody gives things to everybody, Christmas. And then she just waded into you. She says that a man they call Sandy Claus, not a white man, you know, but a kind of Chinaman, comes down the chimney night afore Christmas and gives things to children. Boys like me. Puts them in their boots. That's what she tried to play upon me. Easy now, Pop, where are you rubbing to? That's a mile from the place. She just made that up, didn't she? Just to aggravate me and you. Don't rob there. Why, Dad!"
In the great quiet that seemed to have fallen upon the house, the sigh of the near pines and the drip of leaves without was very distinct. Johnny's voice, too, was lowered as he went on.
"Don't you take on now, for I'm getting all right fast. What the boys doing out there?"
The old man partly opened the door and peered through. His guests were sitting there sociably enough, and there were a few silver coins and a lean buckskin purse on the table.
"Betting on something. Some old game or another. They're all right," he replied to Johnny,
and recommenced his rubbing.
"I'd like to take a hand and win some money," said Johnny.
The old man repeated that if Johnny would wait until he struck it rich in the tunnel, he'd have lots of money.
"Yes," said Johnny, "but you don't. And whether you strike it or not, or I win it, it's about the same. It's all luck. But it's mighty curious about Christmas, ain't it? Why do they call it Christmas?"
Perhaps from some instinctive deference to the overhearing of his guests, or from some vague sense of incongruity, the old man's reply was so low as to be inaudible beyond the room.
"Yes," said Johnny, with some slight abatement of interest. "I heard of him before. Thar, that'll do, Dad. I don't ache near so bad as I did. Now wrap me tight in this here blanket. So, now sit down here by me till I go to sleep."
To assure himself of obedience, he disengaged one hand from the blanket, and grasping his father's sleeve, again composed himself to rest.